And welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's with you every Monday through Friday, noon to 2 here on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF. Out of Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO, serving Ocean City and the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. There's a lot of talk these days about the need to create more pedestrian and biker-friendly streets in cities and their immediate suburbs. In fact, more and more civic groups in American cities, including Baltimore, are encouraging people to commute on foot or by bicycle. It's cheap, healthy, and, as I say, environmentally impeccable. But is it safe? A lot of people are concerned about that. A lot of people say, no, it still isn't safe. To counter that trend, organizations have launched efforts to increase awareness and reduce pedestrian-involved accidents here. And that brings us to this larger question. After decades of designing streets primarily for the motorists, for cars and trucks and buses, how can American cities make sufficient room for the pedestrian and the pedalist? What makes a modern street complete, too? Another question for today's show. Is it the architecture, the landscaping, the width of streets and the sidewalks? How do you create something practical and even charming on streets that have been jammed with cars, trucks, and buses for decades? And what's more, how can we design better streets for the future, a future that could involve the self-driving car? It's Midday on Design this hour. We'll be focusing on our discussion on the movement toward creating smarter, friendlier city streets and suburban streets as more Americans take to them. With me for this discussion is Midday contributor Klaus Philipson, president of ArcPlan Incorporated here in Baltimore. Klaus is a Baltimore architect who blogs as Community Architect and appears on our show from time to time to talk about urban design and city living and suburban living. And Klaus, nice to have you back with us on the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
And Klaus, I want to mention right away, I mentioned your blog in passing there. I've been enjoying it more and more. Klaus, as I say, blogs as Community Architect. You can find links to his essays. These are really nice, long essays. One of which I posted today is about the Complete Street movement that you wrote earlier this year. And another one more recently about the idea of the self-driving car and the impact that could have on city life and city streets. So anyway, I just thought I'd mention that to our listeners. So Klaus, thanks for being with us today. And we're joined by Victor Dover today. Victor Dover is a leading practitioner of the new urbanism movement, which encourages design that's geared toward the pedestrian. Victor Dover is the co-founder of the Florida-based design firm Dover, Cole and Partners Town Planning. And we have him on the show today for that reason, and because he's also the co-author of a new book all about this, Street Design, it's called, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns. Wiley is the publisher. So we're happy to have Victor Dover joining us again today. Victor, welcome to Midday on WYPR Baltimore.
Great to be here, Dan.
As we move along throughout the show today, we're going to talk about the streets you consider great streets already and streets that could become great streets. And we're going to talk about some of those here in Baltimore because Klaus brought his own list. I want to ask you about this term, complete street. I like how that sounds. What makes a street complete? And the idea of a complete street. Let's start with that definition, Victor, and go from there.
Well, the Complete Streets movement defines complete streets as those thoroughfares that are set up for all of the users and for many purposes, not just for driving back and forth, but for also cycling or walking, conducting business or holding a parade. The Complete Streets movement has really gained a lot of headway over the last decade or so. There's a National Complete Streets Coalition, and hundreds of municipalities and state governments have adopted complete streets policies, which say when you go out to design your street, keep all those other users in mind.
Klaus, when you look back to 100 years, 150 years, cities, Baltimore in particular, do you see complete streets? Were streets once upon a time complete in that definition?
Yeah, Victor's definition of a great street is not complete streets, and he will say that probably in a moment, because it's a street that's great to be in and not just a street to go from A to B. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, Baltimore as a historic city has great DNA and good bones because it's essentially laid out and developed before the car. And many other communities in Maryland are also, and even suburbs, because they started as streetcar suburbs. And so in a streetcar suburb, it was essential that you could walk to the stop. And so the layout is based on those distances that you can manage on foot. So the starting point is a good one. And the complete street movement is really oftentimes geared to those environments that are either new suburbs or new cities, like we have them in Florida, or, you know, mm-hmm. not insulting Florida in any way, but new cities oftentimes are not built around walking. They are built around cars. And these accident statistics that just came out last week, they show that the southern cities have a much higher pedestrian fatality rate than northern cities usually do, and older cities usually do. The funny thing, or not funny in this case, tragic thing really, is that Baltimore, in spite of its good bones, ranks in the bottom half of those accident statistics. So what we have is streets that are physically good, but we have, if one can call that a culture, in the street that is not so good, and is we can talk about this in some more detail later.
Yes, Victor, I'll go back to you on that. So in your book, Street Design, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns, of course, you are looking at older cities, but some must fit this description that Klaus just gave us, that were originally complete streets, great streets, actually. But over the years, over the decades of with automobiles and trucks, have lost that original charm.
Well, you're right. And in fact, Klaus is right to call me out on the fact that for all the praise we heap on the Complete Streets movement, we're also critics who say just because it technically has a bike lane or is some other perfunctory indication that pedestrians or cyclists are welcome there, doesn't mean it's a great place for people to be where they'll really enjoy it and want to be there. And so my co-author, John Massengale, who's an architect and urbanist in New York City, has often said, we need complete streets or completer streets, meaning that it's not really a complete street yet unless it's a place where people want to be. If it's not beautiful, for example, or pleasant, it's not a complete street. Now, just because those accident statistics are so much worse in the newly built cities in the Sun Belt doesn't mean any part of the country is spared. In fact, we have a lot of those pedestrian fatalities happening in suburban Maryland.
I just want to mention that the study that Klaus and Victor has referred to, this is a study released by the National Complete Streets Coalition just last week, 10 days ago. Baltimore was ranked 28th on the list, most dangerous cities in the United States for pedestrians. That's out of a total of 51 major metropolitan areas. So you're right, Klaus, this is the bottom half of that. The study reported 482 pedestrian fatalities between 2003 and 2012. Nationally, pedestrian deaths have been on the rise since 2009, according to the National Complete Streets Coalition. I'm curious what that means. It means people are walking more, yet they're still walking on the same streets that have been dominated by traffic, by the automobile.
Yeah, I haven't studied the entire methodology of
this
study.
That's one thing it could mean.
Obviously,
though, right?
When you walk more, you have the potential for more accidents. But it does also mean that, as Victor pointed out, you know, this is the Baltimore region. It's not just Baltimore City. We have a higher than, we are actually quite bad. We are almost twice as high in the proportion of pedestrians killed out of total traffic fatalities, which is nationally about 10.7% or so. And locally here it was 20%. So mm-hmm. This means that people are in a high risk when they bike or when they walk. Just simply walking along a street can be very dangerous. And we had just recently a lot of accidents where cars wound up in stores. And it's just bizarre, you know, that mm-hmm. you are going about your business in a store and then you get hit by a car.
My theory then, Victor, is what I'm suggesting to Klaus here in the studio is that, you know, people are walking more, trying to use bikes more. But nothing else has changed. If nothing else changes, if you don't make accommodations for that in design, this you could have more fatalities. You could have more accidents. I mean, it seemed to me there's a logic in that.
That's right. You know, for about 60 or 70 years, cities were reconfigured on an experimental basis around higher and higher speed driving. Mm-hmm. Basically, we got this new technology, which was faster than horses, and said, let's see what we can do with it, and pushed all other priorities to the side, including the pedestrians who were kicked to the side on the sidewalks, and then in many cases, especially on the arterial streets, just pushed out altogether. And the result of that experiment is you can now see on the ground, a continent-wide experiment that was carried out without a field test. It's one where driving fast begets more driving. The roads that were designed and redesigned for higher speeds to try and get people there faster really just enabled them to roam farther, and so they did. And it's a self-perpetuating problem. So the big deal is we have to make streets safe by slowing some of them down. That doesn't mean we need to get out there and reconfigure the interstate highway to between towns to make it into a main street. Certainly there are going to be high-speed roads. What we need to do is go into the city and into the town centers and into the neighborhoods and stop designing those streets as if they're interstate highways or the Indianapolis 500. When you bring the speed down, everything changes. Now, that technology of the car just got better and better in terms of speed, and then they began to react to the safety problems by making the occupants inside the car safer, more airbags, more seatbelts, more warning devices, and so on. And then the exterior environment outside the vehicle was just changed by adding more stripes and more signs and more flashing signals and so on in an attempt to curb the behavior or deal with the fact that somebody was probably going to drive fast. Very little was done for the safety and comfort of those people who are outside the vehicle trying to walk down the street that Klaus described. That's why I think your first point is the most important one. The historical cities were designed with streets that were paced according to pedestrians. We had people out there getting on and off streetcars. We had Model Ts and horses and buggies and horses and lots of pedestrians all interacting, but more or less doing so at the pace where the pedestrians were in control. And if there was a streetcar coming, you could step out of the way. Once we sped everything up, we really increased the mayhem, and that's what the Dangerous by Design 2014 report shows. We talk a lot about this in the street design book because it turns out that the streets that are pleasant places for people to be, which come with the recycling effect that has on cities that revitalize their historic centers and preserve their historic neighborhoods, well, those are places where the pace is slower. So it is that simple. We actually just need to bring down the speeds. Now, there's some interesting new data. Because over the last 10 years, we've had such a resurgence in those cyclists and pedestrians and transit users that you spoke about, we're now starting to see a safety dividend. For example, in New York City, where they made a concerted effort over the last decade to reintroduce cycling into First Manhattan and then the outer boroughs, in that city, they studied what happened in the accidents. And it's very interesting. Turns out the factor that makes it safest for more people to ride is for more people to be out there riding their bikes. In other words, safety.
Not surprised, right? Safety in numbers. Hey, before we take our break here, first break in this hour of midday with Victor Dover and Klaus Philipson, I want to ask you both just briefly to talk a little bit about placemaking as part of this. Because this, you know, we can talk about streets and putting in bicycle lanes and things like that. But the idea of creating a place for people, a safe place where people feel this charm I spoke about earlier, about being on the street with others. Could you talk just a little bit about that, Klaus, first?
Well, if we take our two first points about complete streets and then safety and tie them together, we get to placemaking. Mm. Because as Victor writes somewhere in his book, that more tubes is not making the complete street. So more lines on the street and more bicycle lanes and all that isn't really getting us there because the speed might not go down. So the old street had a lot of confusion in it. You know, jaywalking didn't exist. You could cross the street anywhere you wanted, and people did it. When you look at those old pictures from the 50s and even earlier in Baltimore, you see very lively streets, and there was everything going every which way, you know, horse carriages.
Street cars, yep.
And that made it slow, and that made it safe. And so a complete street is one where you have a certain amount of confusion. And as Victor will certainly speak about, is that the traffic engineers have a penchant for ordering things. And so the more ordered it is, the faster everybody goes and the more righteous everybody becomes and says, well, you stepped over the lane, you are in my territory. Right. And that's the behavior we don't want.
And place is lost.
And so when we have a real place, we don't have all this clutter and all these lines, we just have a good place.
Victor, a little bit from you on that. I can actually quote your book because I found this quote interesting. You say the formulaic, seemingly ubiquitous use of yellow pedestrian crossings, red bus lanes, green bicycle tracks, ugly bump outs, and uglier white plastic sticks, or those tubes that Klaus mentioned, makes sense in the narrow focus of the specialist, right? But look at the world's best streets, as we have, and you will find they don't have these special things.
That's right. In fact, the real principles that bring about comfort and walkability and that sense of place that you're describing have almost nothing to do with the debris of bright, reflective signs and stripes and things that are often poured into streets as if they're highways. In fact, that green bike lane, you notice, is exactly the same color green as the hue of the sign for the exit ramp on the interstate highway. It's just highway stuff that we've started putting in now in the name of pedestrians and cyclists instead of in the name of motorists. But when you step back and look at it, that still looks like auto space. And so the message we're all subtly getting, maybe not so subtly, is that this is really a space for cars in which we're grudgingly accepting pedestrians and cyclists. Now, if you want to find the things that seem to really work, like those historic examples we present in the book, I think there are five things you can see over and over and over. Safety is one of them, but it's only one. First, they have a shape. They're defined. Urban designers often say like a public room. They have the walls form, that's buildings and trees that form the sides of it, and then they have the floor, which is where we have our pavement and our sidewalks and the like. And that room shape is one of the things that pedestrians just seem to need. You know, when that's absent or when the proportion is wrong, it's too wide and too flat, you don't feel comfortable there. And then there's the bigger piece to comfort, which is that the great historic streets are almost effortlessly always climate adapted. They have street trees in, say, temperate climes where you want the leaves lost in the winter so that you can warm the inside of buildings, but you want the canopy to come back in the summer to keep things cool. That simple kind of climate adaptation is one of the things that these great streets always have. And the safety, sure, it means not being afraid of getting run over by a car, but it also means you have what Jane Jacobs called eyes on the street, that sense of natural surveillance, a crime prevention person would call it, which is that there are doors and windows and balconies and storefronts overlooking that street, and they send a message that this is somebody's place, and if you are going to do something bad here, you might get caught. Or if you're going to call for help here, you might get heard. That's a safety message just as important as the one about not getting run over. Then these streets always go somewhere, especially the main streets. They're connected to the larger world of the city. They're not at all like the cul-de-sacs that lead nowhere. You come back out the way you went in.
Victor, we have
and
to take
the last our, test is going to be interesting.
Excuse me. I'm sorry, Victor. I thought we had got up to number five. I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Why don't you go to your last point, then we need to take a break.
Just that pedestrians are easily bored. It's got to be interesting. It's got to be memorable.
Okay. Let's come back and talk some more about that. We need to take a break here on midday. We want to hear from you, too, so we'll open the phone lines to our midday listeners. What do you appreciate in a great street? What do you consider a great street here in Maryland, Baltimore, anywhere in the suburbs of the city or anywhere in our state? I'll tell you in a moment how to give us a ring. We're joined here in this hour by Baltimore architect Klaus Philipson, who blogs as Community Architect, and Victor Dover is with us with his co-author, John Massingale, author of Street Design, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns. Here's how to reach us on midday. 410-662-8780. Our midday email address, midday@wypr.org. The Dan Roderick's Facebook page has plenty of posts on this subject today. You can post comments there that I'll be glad to read on the air. Some interesting comments already on Facebook on this subject, mostly about biking and trying to make Baltimore, Annapolis, other smaller cities in Maryland more biker-friendly. Ernst writes in to say, I am hopeful that Baltimore and Annapolis can find a way to become more bike-friendly. Right now, it is passable at best, Baltimore City does have a master plan for bicycling and in Baltimore City, so that more improvements are expected. Gregory says, I bike to work from Hamilton to Morgan State, and I bike for exercise in the city, Baltimore County, and other parts of the state, but almost no drivers know how to deal with cyclists. There's a lack of education there. Jennifer says, workplaces need showers when the biker workers arrive at the office, especially in humid Baltimore when it's above 90 degrees. She says, I worked 5 miles from my house when I was a prosecutor. What stopped me from bicycling to work was that I had nowhere to shower and change into dry, clean clothes when I arrived. So that may have to be an accommodation that's made in the future. Dan Roderick's here on Midday, joined today by Victor Dover, co-author of Street Design, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns. Victor, we need to talk about some of these, some of the streets that you like. The book is published by Wiley, and Klaus Philipson with us. Klaus, I wanted to go back to you a little bit on that idea of a street being more than just a conduit from one place to another, but a place.
Yeah, I mean, we should not forget that cities are the one place-making element that defines cities, towns, and suburbs, and that there are reasons why they are laid out the way they are laid out. So it's not just all totally random or that someday people had a bad day and then they designed bad streets.
Mm-hmm.
The cities are expressions, or streets are expressions of society. And there are a lot of other things going on streets, you know, parades and marches and revolts and markets and... Yeah, so when you have suburbs where the streets are really bad, which not all suburbs the streets are bad, but some are, then you don't have parades anymore because you can't do a parade on a cul-de-sac. And so you are losing a lot of the civic life. And I think the 50s were an age of privatization. We privatized parks and made them private lawns, and we took... the private life into our houses, locked ourselves up and watched television. And so the porches lost their sense because you're not on it anymore. And the streets lost their sense because you were always in your house and tried to get everything there. And we are realizing that this lifestyle doesn't make us happy. And so the street now has a renaissance along with the public space and the place as such.
And you think we're on the edge here, on the verge of a new era in transportation design?
Well, that's one aspect. I mean, there are all kinds of disruptive technologies that come along that we can only guess what they will do. And the self-driving car is one. The sensing cities are one. And the challenge for urban designers is to make these technologies not overrun us like the car once did, but make them useful so that our cities become better places.
Mm-hmm. And so that they can coexist with pedestrians and people on bicycles, right? Hey, Victor, I want to go to you now and just go through some of the lists I have here put together of some of your favorite places and the reasons why. If you don't mind, I want to start with your favorite street in Maryland when it comes to street design. And why don't we start in Annapolis, and we'll go from there.
Main Street is a great classic American Main Street in Annapolis. And of course, we can find comparable streets in many towns, not just in Maryland, but around the country. But I love that street because you go there, it has a realness to it, despite the fact that it's been carefully fought over and preserved and what have you. But there's just something about the geometry of that street which feels good. They made an address when they laid it out, the drawing lines on a map. You know, they've set it up so that at the end of that street, you're focused on the church, on St. Anne's. There's a place where Francis Street breaks off and creates a vista up to the State House. And you're in that place. It's undeniably civic in the way that Klaus described. And it's also worth looking at that street for its fine grain. You know, smaller buildings built over time, not all the same age, not all the same architecture. Some beautifully renovated and preserved, others, you know, terribly harmed over the years. In the end, it all adds up because of that fine grain to something very comfortable, an address that's worth recycling. You make that place where people want to be, they come back there.
Hey, Victor, I'm a fan of the boulevard. I love the word boulevard. I like what a boulevard means, and in my mind, what a boulevard is. And I wish we had more of them. But the wide street, you know, historically wide street, wide sidewalks, where you got plenty of room on a sidewalk. This is what I have in mind anyway. Tree-lined, sort of a garden aspect to parts of it maybe, and then the street traffic is quite separate from the pedestrian traffic. I mean, that's my basic idea of a boulevard. But do you have a place like that in the United States you could talk about?
Sure, and we dropped one on your Facebook page. It's Eastern Parkway, which, while called a parkway, because it's a great linear park, is actually a multi-lane, multi-way boulevard.
I have to mention that there are some photographs on our Facebook page, and the one that Victor just mentioned, Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, is right there. Thank you, Victor.
Designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, the father of landscape architecture in the modern sense. And it's exactly as you described, the simple lines of trees that grow up over the canopy over the space where the pedestrian walks. And a place for local traffic, a place for through-going traffic. Many of these streets, like the ones in Paris and in America, were not designed around cars. They were designed around horses and carriages. But they adapted beautifully to the introduction of motor vehicles. And so I think the important message is, while we love skinny streets, we also recognize there will be some streets that need to be through-going and are wide and ceremonial.
Mm-hmm.
And they just have to be designed appropriately. And Eastern Parkway is a classic example of how to do that. You know, the new technologies, those disruptive technologies that Klaus mentioned, the car was one of those. Just 110 years ago, it was assumed that this was going to change everything. The breakpoint was probably in the mid-1920s when people really got organized around changing all the standards and putting the car at the top of the food chain when it comes to satisfying its needs in this habitat. And that's what happened. You know, they basically began to assume the new technology changes everything. We have to throw all that was learned from 5,000 years of human experience about city building out the window and remake around the new technology. Let's hope we don't do that around self-driving cars or Segways or anything else.
Closer to home here, Klaus, do you have an example of a great street? And start with maybe one that's similar to what we were just talking about, the wide boulevard.
Well, Utah Place, for example, has the park-like median in the middle with two rows of trees and some monuments and wide sidewalks and big buildings on the side that frame it all. Gwynns Falls Parkway. Sometimes these streets are ones where we had streetcars in the middle and then they were abandoned and they became linear parks in the middle. The Alameda. So we do have a bunch of those that are still very beautiful, and then we have some others that suffered in the process, like North Avenue, where we are currently working on reconfiguring it.
Our phone number here at Midday is 410-662-8780. If you'd like to join our conversation and talk about a great street and why you consider it a great street, we're joined by Klaus Philipson, president of Arc Plan Incorporated. The community architect is how he blogs and joins us from time to time on Midday. And Victor Dover is with us. Victor Dover, along with John Massengale, are authors of Street Design, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns. And a couple of emails I wanted to read from our listeners. Peter says, I would like to hear your guests talk about bump outs. As a cyclist, I find them very dangerous. They force me from the side of the lane to the center of the lane where the cars are. Bump outs don't slow the cars either. They seem like a waste of money to me. A comment on that, Victor?
Sure. They have a lot of nicknames. Traffic engineers call them curb extensions. They're also called bulb outs or pork chops. This is where the curb steps out toward the center of the street at the crosswalk, ostensibly to make it shorter for pedestrians to get across from curb to curb, which it does do. But it also tends to make the curve at the corner, that corner radius, really big, which is a very pedestrian-unfriendly feature. And they look very artificial and strange. If you look at the historical cities, they just don't have that stuff. So we're harsh critics of them. I will say that we found one or two we like. There's one on the street called Worth Avenue in the town of Palm Beach, which we single out for praise. Here and there, a great tool, not a great idea for everywhere. And I'm one of those cyclists who's as annoyed about them as your correspondent.
Let's take a phone call. Peter in Towson joining us here on Midday Today. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a question, and it may be too general, but I grew up in California, and I just am sensing a real difference in pedestrian sensitivity from the East Coast and the West Coast. When I'm on the West Coast, it seems that drivers are much more willing to honor the pedestrian. And on the East Coast, I feel like I'm a target half the time. And I was just wondering if you might be able to comment on that. I'll take the comments off the air.
Okay, Peter, East versus West on that. I'll start with Victor and then go to Klaus for comments.
It's interesting. We get that same comment for North versus South, and we get that same comment for the coast versus the outback in Australia. Everybody thinks that where they used to be is more pedestrian-friendly than where they are now. But I think that your caller is on to something. In fact, we do need better driver education when it comes to looking out for pedestrians and cyclists. I will say we need better cyclist education and better pedestrian education, too. I was at a meeting last week, and one of the comments was, we don't need just better pedestrian crossings. We need better pedestrians who are paying attention and aren't looking down at their phone while they're stepping into the crosswalk. And as far as my friends, the cyclists, we need for them to, you know, follow the rules and, you know, stop when they need to stop and go the right way down the street instead of riding in the opposite lane the wrong way against traffic, things that you've all seen from time to time. So the truth is we need education all around and not just in one state or one region or another, but everywhere.
Well, it's really this culture thing. You know, it's a civic behavior where we look out for each other and where a pedestrian that steps into a crosswalk is not a target, where the car driver says, well, you know, I'm bigger than you and I'll just make it through and without stopping, which is the culture that we have here. And I travel a lot, probably not as much as Victor does, but I do see the differences. It's not just nostalgia. There is clearly many regions in the country where people are much more considerate in traffic than they are here. Mm-hmm. And the accident rates and the insurance rates actually bear this out. There are statistics about that. It's not just the perception. And we do need a different culture development. It's not all about physical, you know, bump outs or no bump outs. It's also about enforcement, for example, that we have a ton of cops always checking speed on the interstates, where I don't see any need for that because, you know, as a German, I like to run on the Autobahn. The Autobahn.
You mean versus the city or suburban streets?
In the city, where it would really be important that the police pay attention to speed. People are barreling down Edmondson Avenue where kids walk to school and where people wait for the bus. And the parking lane is during rush hour, a travel lane. You know, it's one of my things that a complete street and a good street should never, ever have a parking lane that's given up for a rush hour lane. And then when you have a permanent parking lane, then you can make also a bump out proper. Because then you look at the bump out not as a bump out, but a carve out for the cars to park. And then when you bike, you don't come to a bump out, but you just bike along the parked cars. And the parked cars separate the people from the moving cars. And so then you don't get splattered when it rains, when you wait for the bus. And the bump out would also be a good place for a bus stop and people to have some space. So, you know, there could be a good part to it, but it is a culture thing, and we do have too much of a free-for-all, which is, I speculate that this has something to do with the lack of social cohesion. There are, you know, it's the litter is one aspect of it, and the general disregard for the common public space that we all share.
Klaus Fulz, I'm sorry, Victor.
Can I get a comment in there?
Quickly, please.
This is really not just a regional thing, but a generational thing. We hand out those little keypad polling devices to big audiences when we're doing plans. We asked about 400 people recently, did your parents walk to school? And about 90% of them said yes. And then we asked, when you were a kid, did you walk to school? And a little more than 60% said yes. And then, of course, you know what's next. We asked, do the kids in your family or in your household or your neighborhood, do they walk to school? And only about 10% said yes.
Right.
So what you're seeing there is an indication of civilization in decline, in fact, because the streets are where our civilization unfolds. People want to be out there, but they're not comfortable about it. We need to make a lot more people comfortable, and then these problems will self-correct.
Victor Dover is the co-founder of the Florida-based design firm Dover, Cole & Partners Town Planning. He's the co-author of Street Design, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns, which is the reason we invited him onto the show today, with Klaus Philipson, a community architect and president of Arc Plan Incorporated here in Baltimore. 410-662-8780 is the way to reach us here on Midday. If you'd like to join our conversation and share with us what you consider a great street in Maryland or wherever you've been, please we welcome your phone call or your email, midday@wypr.org. And I want to go right to the phone lines and hear from our listeners here as we're joined in conversation this hour by Klaus Philipson and Victor Dover talking about great streets, what makes a great street, and how to accommodate more pedestrians and bicyclists in the city and suburban areas on streets that have been for decades dominated by the automobile, cars, and trucks. Kim in Baltimore, we welcome you to Midday. Go right ahead, Kim.
Hi, yes. I wanted to say that I think the secret, and I haven't listened to the whole show, but the secret was discovered a long time ago. If you look at historic photographs, even going back into the 1800s, of houses, even if they're just built, and regardless of whether it is a very modest house or really an opulent house, you'll see that there is at least one tree planted in front of that house. And it's not a small tree, it's a forest tree. And it lined the streets. And I noticed that I don't want to walk wherever there's not trees. And you look at a day like today where it's in the 90s, I don't want to walk where there's not trees. But I also don't even want to live where there's not trees. And you see right now, you see so many situations where, you know, there's maybe a big lawn or something like that, green grass, but there's no trees, and it's really uninviting to walk around, whether it's your neighborhood or something more urban. Thank you. And also, I guess I want to know is, like, what can we do and how to encourage people to, once again, line the streets with forest trees?
Yeah, and I saw that our producer wrote on the screen there, how can we continue to do this with new bike lanes, which, you know, brings in this question about design. This is for Victor and Klaus to handle, but I do have that same question, too. How do you accommodate all of this? Klaus, you were earlier describing a way for bicycles to have room next to a sidewalk, or on a sidewalk or close to a sidewalk without interfering with car traffic. I saw a photograph of that, with something that's called a cycle track, right? In terms of the amount of space that you have in Baltimore, any city, especially the older cities, how do you retrofit to include all that? Trees, maybe a wider sidewalk, place for bicycles, and can keep traffic moving?
Well, it's a complicated thing because we don't have more space than we got. Right. And so that's why the ultimate solution would be naked streets, which is the streets that I described earlier, where you don't put all the lanes and the clutter in, but people share the space. And when they drive slow enough, I was just coming back from Germany a week there, you know, the enforcement of speed limits in the cities is just much, 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 much more stricter than here. And all their residential streets are limited to 30 kilometers per hour, so that's 18 miles per hour, universally.
Wow!
And if you go faster, there are speed cameras, and you get your ticket. And so
the speed cameras at work, right?
Then on the other hand, you have currently in the transition phase where more people want to go back to the bike but feel terribly unsafe to just share space. There is a belief that, you know, a bike lane is a good lane when you can send your kid on it. And so the European solution is usually that the bicycle moves as an extension of the sidewalk above the curb. And we never do that because the original bicyclists, as Victor also describes in his book, were these kind of, super active bicyclists that say, well, I'm like a vehicle, I want the whole lane. And so we are moving very gradually through these various phases. And in the transition, we probably have to accept some of these white sticks and stuff because it makes bicyclists feel safer. And in the transition phase where we are not so great in numbers yet, you know, I just came on by bike today again. I also want to suggest that we get finally a bike rack out of the outside the studio.
Out here at WYPR, okay. We could suggest that. You're welcome to bring it in. Did you bring it into the lobby?
No.
Okay, it's outside.
Yes.
Okay. Victor, from you on that, about accommodating all these interests and all these desires we have.
Well, Klaus is on the right track. In many cases, the answer is shared space, because when you're moving more slowly, there's time to react, and the motorist isn't creating such peril or such noise and violence into the character of the street as well. This is really about rebalancing. The balance was shifted where it was all about all driving all the time, and wider and faster roads are better roads. That was the philosophy for such a long time. We're not talking about getting rid of cars, in fact, or causing traffic to suddenly grind to a halt. In fact, what we are suggesting is just a gentle move of rebalancing to get that certain amount of space back and a certain amount of attitude back for those pedestrians and cyclists that breathe life into the street of the city. That's how you find room for those street trees. You know, the in fact, people ask me all the time, what are the two things that we should do most important and soonest and with the least amount of effort that would make the most difference? And I always say, plant street trees and encourage cycling, because those two things, more than anything else, will help restore the balance that your caller was after.
And those both of these policies are in effect in Baltimore City. So every street redesign has to have a bicycle accommodation in the state of Maryland as well as in Baltimore City. And we have a reforestation project underway. The mayor's goal is to double the street at the tree canopy. And unfortunately, we don't have really good standards as to how to plant these trees so that they would actually live and that they are not planted as tiny little broomsticks.
Here's a comment from Catherine writing to us from Frederick, Maryland. Frederick seems to be a very pedestrian-oriented town now. I'm always amazed at the number of people either strolling for pleasure or going about their daily business on foot. On the other hand, the brick sidewalks can be treacherous. The streets are narrow, and most are one way, and there are traffic lights at every corner. However, parking is somewhat limited and not cheap, too, but it all seems to work. It is a destination as well as a living space. I want to take a call from Pasadena. This is Meg giving us a ring on midday. Go right ahead, Meg.
Hi. We just returned from Amsterdam and Copenhagen. We spent 2 weeks, and we were astounded at the difference in the way the cars behave on those roads. There are lights with symbols for pedestrians to cross and for the bikers to cross, and they go first. Mm-hmm. The cars do not go into the walkways, ever. We were there in each of those two cities for 4 days each, and they never cross into the walkways. It's like they've been taught from childhood, because it's been, I think, 60 years since Amsterdam and Copenhagen have started changing their pedestrian and their road systems. It was just an eye-opener.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Meg. Let's get comment from Victor on that.
Well, I think we should take all the American traffic engineers to Amsterdam and have them look around, not because we would necessarily create Amsterdam and every one of our cities, but because they will see something really, really powerful, which is what happens when pedestrians and cyclists call the shots. And what happens when you ask the cars to behave as if they're using someone else's space? In fact, the inverse of what we see on most American
city
streets.
I would also just want to add that something I actually missed a little bit in Victor's book is some examples of Europe that are not the historic ones, but the new subdivisions and the new developments where Europeans build to the current standards of living, you know, not the quaint old stuff. And still, they are building very narrow streets, and they're making all these accommodations for pedestrians and bicyclists and make them safe so that kids can walk to school, have smaller front yards. I think we could learn a lot from the new suburbs in Europe as well, and not just from the historic cities.
Speaking of new streets, quickly from Victor, I'd like to hear about Swift Street in Buena Vista, Colorado.
I love the name because it's the opposite of the design speed. It's not a fast street. It's not Swift. It's named after the traffic engineer, Peter Swift, who signed the drawings that said, yes, if we make it this skinny and this slow and this bumpy, it'll be safe. And so Swift Street is the skinniest new street in Colorado. There's no chance that someone will speed on that street because of its tight curvature and its river rock surface and its tight dimensions. There's every chance that kids will be out there playing anytime you go to visit it. There's another feeling you get when you're in Swift Street, which is that the architecture has just extended down off the buildings and into the garden walls and into the street itself. So it feels like one design idea in that place. And I think it's a new street of the kind that Klaus mentioned that has some of the characteristics of the old ones that make them worth writing about.
Here's another comment by email from Alexa regarding a place in Colorado, Telluride. My hometown, she says, the main street is very wide since it was an old cowboy town with room for horses and carriages. Today, with the narrow canyon making in-town parking a challenge, there is one line of parking right down the middle of the street for locals and regular parking along the curb for everyone. Also, at every block, large barrels of flowers have been placed in the street as a reminder that pedestrians have the right of way, traffic moves slowly, and there's loads of activity on the street, Telluride, Colorado. You can find more examples of great streets in Victor's book, Victor Dover, with John Massingale, the authors of Street Design, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns. I just wanted to take a minute here to talk to Klaus about the self-driving car. You have this nice, very interesting essay on your blog about this. And in terms of what we're talking about today, street design, the way we sort of coexist, pedestrians, motorists, bicyclists, what are your thoughts? Just to give us a little taste of that essay, and we'll send people to read the rest of it, Klaus, about the self-driving car.
It clearly has two sides to it. First off, I do believe that it will come, and of course the self-driving car becomes only interesting when every car is self-driving.
Right.
Because then you get possible benefits, but you get also downsides. So first off, the capacity of streets will almost double because you can fit a lot more in. So this has the potential that all the negative impacts that came from cars would just sort of have a renaissance and you would get more of it. But if you do it right...
Excuse me, do you think more people would share cars? Is that primarily
No, because when you fit double the cars in, then you have all the congestion is all of a sudden gone. And so driving becomes a lot more attractive again. I mean, driving, sitting in the car.
Well, the cars are just smarter than we are.
They can space much closer together and all that. But then there are also benefits. You know, these self-driving cars would not run over pedestrians as much. And also, there are huge opportunities that come from it for cities by having a lot less space needed for parking. And that particular goes not only when you set off the car to park itself, but also when a lot more sharing would be used. And so that the car isn't your personal property, where 95% of the time sits idle, but that cars are just used as a means of transportation.
Did you ever thought about that, Victor, before we leave you?
Well, sure. There have been many new technologies that have been introduced over the years. We used to have cities that didn't have to worry about cars. Well, guess where the cities are best performing economically and even for traffic congestion? It's where the streets are connected in a grid. That's the old town. It's where the streets are narrow and slow and the pedestrians have a fighting chance and the cyclists love it. That's the old town. Let's build like the old town and it'll accommodate new technologies.
The Prince of Wales wrote the foreword for Victor Dover's book with his co-author John Massingale. Again, it's published by Wiley. Street Design, The Secret to Great Cities and Towns. Thanks for being with us today, Victor.
Thank you.
And you can read Klaus Philipson's essay about the robotic car, the self-driving car, and what impact that could have on city life and urban and suburban life. You can find a link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Klaus Philipson blogs as community architect. He's president of ArcPlan Incorporated of Baltimore. Thanks for being with us again, Klaus.
Thank you, and thanks for Victor joining us.
And thanks, everyone. That's the first hour of midday. We'll take a break now for lunch from Bagby Pizza Company, and we'll be back for the second hour of our show.